One of the most remarkable aspects of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright. On June 28, 1914, a Bosnian Serb by the name of Gavrilo Princip assassinated Archduke Franz Ferdinand of Austria and his wife Sophia, Duchess of Hohenberg. This event was the tipping point in a Europe which had already had a long series of diplomatic clashes over European and colonial issues. The Austro-Hungarian monarchy competed with Russia and Serbia for control and influence in the territory and eventually pulled the other great powers such as France, Germany, and Great Britain into the conflict through political alliances and treaties. Although Great Britain and France desired American support, the United States remained neutral. President Woodrow Wilson won re-election in 1916 in part because of his promise to keep the United States out of the war. The United States did not enter World War I until April 1917. It was during this time of pre-American involvement that a German missionary, Elder Wilhelm Kessler, serving in Switzerland, left the mission field and returned to his native Germany to serve his country. Here to talk about this missionary and the correspondence he maintained with his American mission president is Jeffrey L. Anderson. Jeffrey, welcome back to the Mormon Channel.
Thank you.
Please take a few minutes and tell our listeners about your background, how you ended up where you are, and what you're doing.
Well, I'm an archivist at the Church History Department, and I spend a lot of my time looking for documents and gathering documents, and not so much time reading them and studying them as I've done here, but that's primarily what we do, is go out and look for records that help us understand or better understand the history of the Church, just like these records that we're going to talk about today.
Any current projects you can share with us that you're working on?
Wow, current projects. Yes, we are actually working on a project to gather the records of Latter-day Saint chaplains who served throughout the years and get their story. The chaplains have a unique perspective on life, on the experiences of Latter-day Saints in war, and we're hoping that we can and get a very nice collection of chaplains' records that will help tell that story.
That sounds like something that would be another good episode here in Legacy.
Well, we'll have to talk about that again sometime, I suppose.
So back to the subject at hand. You wrote a paper called Brothers Across Enemy Lines for BYU Studies in 2002, and that's exactly what we're going to be talking about today. It seems to me oftentimes historians perform research because it's personal, like has either something to do with family or the influence that this event has had on you or just deep curiosity. What was the draw for you on this particular story?
Well, I served a mission to Germany. I remember as a young man in the mission field walking down the streets, having grown up, you know, being exposed to World War II, and as I arrived there, walking down the streets and thinking, golly, you know, it wasn't too many years ago there were actually bombs falling out of these skies on these people, and then to go and meet with these people and share the gospel with them, I was really quite taken by them. And when I came back to BYU, my father had advised me to take what he said always a fun class, so I signed up for Inside Hitler's Germany, and the stack of books was about 2 feet deep in that class. I don't know if you would call it a fun class by definition of being easy or whatever, but I was certainly taken by it, and ultimately changed majors multiple times, but wound up actually back in history from a beloved professor, Doug Tobler, and just was really taken by the German people, and that was the emphasis of my degree at BYU.
So give us a quick overview of this story, and then we'll get into some detail about the beginnings and all the way through the end.
Kessler joined the church in Germany, I believe it was about 1907, and came here to Salt Lake City, and worked for the Sweet Candy Company, we think, for a time. He was most likely a bookkeeper. And then in 1912, went on a mission I suppose because of his expertise in the language, they put him in charge of publishing Der Stern. That's the equivalent of what we would call today the Liahona or the Ensign for American Latter-day Saints. And I think he was quite good at that. We talked before we started recording about how good the writing in that time was. I think Kessler had a good sense of the writing also in German. And the war then begins. Hiram Max Smith, who was a general authority, he's in charge of the European missions and is stationed in England, is traveling through Europe and actually is in German with the mission president, Hiram Valentine, when the war begins. And things are pretty tense for them. They're having a hard time getting out of the country and out of Germany, and at the same time they're trying to they recognize that this is a fairly serious thing, and they need to do some things to get the church prepared to face the war. And so they begin kind of restructuring the branches and a few things like that before they finally get out of Germany and return to Switzerland. It's during this time the war has ramped up, and it's about the 20th of August before Valentine. I believe it's not the 20th. Maybe it's the 12th that Valentine finally gets out and ultimately sees these letters that Wilhelm Kessler has written. And Kessler at this time is just a young missionary who's there and feels that pull or whatever it is to go and join up with the German military and serve there. I thought it was interesting as I read through the letters. He must have been a fairly competent young man. The first letter that he writes, he signs it Corporal Kessler. The next letter that I read, he was Sergeant Kessler. And then in the final letter that his commanding officer wrote, he actually says that he was going to be commissioned as an officer and actually had died in the battle before the news of his commission was received by Kessler.
That's a good overview of the whole story, and we will get into more detail as we go along. Let's jump back to his days in the Salt Lake Valley. He wasn't here very long, and you mentioned that he was part of a German community here in the valley. What role did and do these ethnic LDS communities play in the history of the Salt Lake Valley? It seems like there are still some around.
There's still a German ward that meets, and there's some other wards. There's Japanese wards and other Samoan, Tongan wards that meet. Certainly, the various ethnic groups add diversity and color to the society. The Germans were a long-standing group that were here. They gathered together and met in their own meetings and met in their own language. And I think the church has, through the years, wrestled with, do we form these branches and have them kind of maintain that cultural sense, or do we have them spread out and meet in the various branches? And I think there's some good answers either way in favor of doing, gathering them together, gathering those groups together or not. And they still do that. And I think they still wrestle with that to a certain extent. Which of those various groups, what should happen with those various groups? I think it's interesting to note that during this time period, the ethnic Germans here in the United States and in Utah are really having a difficult time. They're Germans, obviously, and they're not too far removed from their country of origin. There is, just like there were with the Japanese during World War II, there's some doubt about their patriotism. There are certain forces in Utah and in the United States that are advocating not teaching German in the schools, which I thought was interesting. If you want to understand your enemy, you may want to know how to read some of the things that they write. So I thought that was interesting. But there were some difficult things that they faced, probably a difficult tightrope that they had to walk to show that they were citizens of the United States and faithful to the United States, and yet probably in their hearts there was a tug toward their own country, and we see that in Kessler. He is obviously a patriotic German and goes off to fight on the German side, which is somewhat of an unusual thing, I think, from the perspective of an American Latter-day Saint who would say, why would you want to do something like that?
So he goes back to Germany, joins the army, and begins this correspondence with his mission president, whom he felt very close to. Mm-hmm. How prevalent was this type of correspondence, that of family and friends on different sides of the war? Do we know of any?
You know, we haven't really collected a lot of those. I suspect that there was a lot of correspondence that occurred, and we don't have a significant number of letters that were exchanged between Latter-day Saints and their family members, either on the American or the British side. There were lots of British Latter-day Saints who fought, or on the German side.
You mentioned that as the two presidents, Valentine and Smith, were coming out of Germany, they were detained for a time, and in your paper mentioned that they were even thought of as British spies, and so it took them a while to get out. There must have been a lot of suspicion, not only with this, but everything. So I'm wondering how these letters made it back and forth without censorship, without being destroyed. Or
that's an interesting puzzle, you know, because there are some interesting things that are going on. Valentine actually later on receives a communication from Smith once Smith's back in England, and asks him to go to France and gather the papers of the French mission. And I think, again, it's a story that's not been told, but I get the sense from Valentine's communication that that they had to get out of Paris pretty quick. You know, in retrospect, we know that it wasn't quite as serious, that the Germans weren't going to make it to Paris. But in 1914, you didn't know that. And so getting the missionaries out of Europe was rather harrowing. We, you know, we've heard the accounts, I think, more prevalently of the missionaries getting out of Europe during World War II. But as I've just brushed into this a little bit and haven't delved into it as deeply as I'd like to, I get a sense that getting the missionaries out of Europe in 1914 may have been even more of a compelling story. And that's a story that waits to be told.
President Valentine, in his writing, says he could see the fighting from Basel, the town he was in.
Right.
The Valentines came on their missions without much of a family, and while they were in Europe, they adopted a girl, and they named her Basel. What's the connection between Basil the daughter and Basil the town? Any?
It is a direct connection.
Really?
That's why they gave her the name. Yeah. And actually, in one of the letters that didn't wind up in the article, Kessler writes about her and about his feelings for her and what a wonderful little girl he sees of her, and sort of this almost a longing for home and a desire to be back in a place where there was peace and love and to hear that little girl's voice as she apparently, based on how Kessler writes about it, walks around the mission home and endears herself to the missionaries and the others who are working there in the mission home.
And they adopted another child after they got home. Is that also true?
Yes. Dee, I'm not sure quite that story. He's a relative. Actually, a blood relative of the Valentines, and I think, I can't remember the details on that. I think it was a brother or a cousin who passed away, and the Valentines adopted Dee. I met Dee a couple of years ago,
wow.
Actually. It was while I was, Rose Valentine wrote a journal, and we have that journal cited in the manuscript history of the Swiss mission, and I was trying to find that journal, And I went down and met with Dee and his daughter, and as I talked with her, she seemed to think that that the journal was probably burned, which is a travesty, I think. But as I was talking to her, I was describing how I was sort of taken by the neutrality of Valentine and how he reflected the American neutrality of the time, and she kind of gave me this look like, really? And I said, yes. And she said, boy, that wasn't the Uncle High there, High that we knew. He was very in favor of being involved in foreign affairs and other things like that, I think, which is a reflection of the transition that the United States experienced as we went through World War II. And also, I think, a transition that Latter-day Saints experienced. You see a very, very different sentiment after World War II than you see before World War II.
We've talked a little bit about Kessler's writing ability. He was the editor of this paper.
Understand.
In just reading some of his words in the letters, I just feel a need to read this short little paragraph just to show what a beautiful writer he was and the type of way they express themselves in the time. This is his letter dated August 3rd, 1914. My dear ones, the deep impressions of my difficult departure from Basel reside with powerful resonance in my soul. The tears of the church members in behalf of the departing brethren were for my tender heart as an edifying rain of love which gently cooled the burning glow of excitement for my fatherland without diminishing the warmth. And I just wish I could write like that.
He writes very well, and Valentine writes well too, I think. There's some really profound communications that go on. I think there are also some that are missing. I get a sense, in fact, Valentine actually, in 1917, 2 days after the war is declared, speaks in General Conference and refers to Kessler. And in that talk, he quotes a letter that we don't have. And I think there are quite a few more letters that were written. You talked about those letters possibly getting lost. I think there probably were quite a few more letters. In fact, when you refer to the difficulty that the church was having and the communications that they were having, I believe it was in 1916, because of the suspicions, the French were concerned that magazines might have codes or whatever embedded in them. And so it was the case at a certain point that Der Stern actually could not be mailed out of Switzerland. It could be mailed into Germany, but not out of Switzerland through France because of the suspicion that the French had that there might be some secrets, troop movements or whatever that would be divulged.
As a reminder, we're talking today with Jeffrey Anderson, archivist with the Church History Library, and we're talking about his article, Brothers Across Enemy Lines, the correspondence between a German soldier and his former mission president. Kessler left his mission to support his native Germany in the war, but not before actually trying to get advice from his mission president. He wrote a couple of letters and was gone to join the army. President Valentine mentioned that things happened very quickly in the beginning of this war, and so it came and it happened, and he was gone and was not able to get that advice. What happened? Why wasn't he able to make the connection?
Well, as I said, Valentine and Smith are there in Germany. It's a little unclear exactly why the communication is limited, whether the Germans were suppressing communication or whether they were, because of the war was starting, there was so much, the lines were tied up or whatever. That's really unclear. But it's evident that for one reason or another, they weren't able to communicate. I think it really ultimately boils down to it was just the complexities of the beginnings of the war and the confusion associated with the war that prevented them from communicating. Rose Valentine, Hiram's wife, writes in her journal that Brother Kessler is very scared. He doesn't really know what to do, and he does write in one of his letters that he's wrestling with this, and he realizes that if the French come across the border into Switzerland, that they may seize him as an enemy combatant, and if the Germans come across the border on the other side, they're going to seize him as a deserter. And so he sees really no solution except to join up. And ultimately, I think as you read his letters, he's a patriot in support of his country. And so even though the war is a difficult thing, obviously, and a horrid thing, he feels like that this is the best thing to do. And so he goes off. I think he would have certainly appreciated Valentine's counsel on that. And my guess is, being who Valentine was, he probably would have tried to figure out a way to get him out of it. I don't know. I mean, we just have to speculate on that, I suppose.
So had he counseled against it based on the letters, based on the feelings of both Kessler and Valentine, do you think the advice would have made any difference?
You know, I don't know. That's interesting. Don't know the character of those individuals well enough to say that. Based on the love and respect that Kessler had for Valentine, he may have done that. But the realities may have been such that truly Kessler couldn't have gotten out of the country and back to the United States without encountering those problems. He would have had to have gone through France or Germany, going south into Italy. Again, you've got a country that's involved in the war, so Switzerland being neutral is really the only place that he could have stayed. And again, and you don't, you have to look at it through their eyes. You don't know how Switzerland was going to be involved in the war at the time. They didn't know how it was going to be involved in the war. With 20/20 hindsight, we could have said, golly, brother Kessler, you just could have sat in Switzerland for the 4 years and things might have been all right for you. But there are, you know, there are some ethical things, I think, that went through his mind about duty and honor and supporting your country. And like I say, we see that as American Latter-day Saints, you see that very differently, because at least the bulk of the Latter-day Saints who are going to be listening to this probably are Americans, and they're maybe a little bit puzzling for them. But I think for Kessler, being a native German, it wasn't a difficult decision to make.
So this whole project was based on the letters. Let's have you pick some of your favorite excerpts.
Let me actually, before we do that, let me read a letter just to give you a sense of Valentine's sentiment about this. And this is actually a letter that Valentine writes. And the source in this is a letter that Hiram Valentine wrote to the Box Elder News. This is for December 1914. He said, "I received my dose of sit and listen and take it all in and say jawohl anyway in Germany, but I haven't the slightest doubt but that a very much similar dose was being administered to every war-weary stranger in each of the other combatant laboratories. You had to smack your lips as well as indicate a pleasant sensation in the stomach as it reached that delicate organ. Any evidence of nausea or vomiting would have been suicide." You know, I read that and say, golly, you know, tell us how you really feel. he had some really strong feelings about the war. And again, throughout the letters that he's writing back home, he points to the horrors of the war and how terrible it is. And in fact, there's a young man by the name of Hoffman who is a native German, and he goes off to war and comes back having lost a leg. And if I may, I'd like to read
please read
this. This is actually out of Valentine's address that he gave on the 8th of April 1917 in General Conference. This is from the General Conference reports. He says, "Brother Hoffman is a man who, before he came into the church, was a social democrat who did not believe in anything. Brother Wright of Ogden was delivering a lecture one night, and this man was passing the door. He heard him and stepped in. He was susceptible to the teachings of the gospel. He joined the church. He's a very fine architect and a supervisor of buildings. He was almost ready to pack his trunk and his grip and come to America, come to Zion, that he might serve the Lord more faithfully. We felt impressed to call him on a mission in March 1914. We called him on a mission, and he gave up his plans gladly and went into the mission field. On August 7th, he became necessary for him to join his regiment. He said, oh, as they buckled on me that the tornister and gave me that shining gun in my hands, Do you know what my prayer was? He said, I prayed to the Lord every night in secret that it might not be my lot to shoot one of my fellow men. I did not want to shoot anybody. And oh, how I rejoiced when, after 7 days in the army, I was assigned to the hospital corps, and I was relieved of the responsibility of shedding the blood of my brethren. He said, I saw an answer to my prayer there. And when I was in that Good Samaritan work, my fellow comrade and I, binding the wounds of a fallen comrade, a grenade fell in between us and tore from him his arm and from me a leg. I thanked God. I said today that I had escaped from that terrible war with the loss of a foot and a leg. Do you know our hearts bled when we saw that big man, after having been released from the hospital, returning to us to enter into the missionary work? He came with an artificial limb, a poorly equipped artificial limb, and two heavy canes, bearing about 200 pounds weight, largely on his hands. The tears rolled down our cheeks, and I wept. Oh, I wept when I saw that many a father and many a mother and many a wife and child has had to pass through this cruel war. But he laughed and said, I am thankful to the Lord that I escaped with the loss of a foot and a leg. He is doing valiant service and has now for 2 years as the editor of our mission paper. I have thought today, as often before, what would be there today were it not for this man. He is almost our only support there, because now we have gotten into the turmoil of war, and the animosity and the hatred that grew up with the war will make itself manifest here. Valentine is really critical of how the war machine, as he sees it, can take young men and chew them up and spit them out. And once they're of no value to the war machine, I guess, those are my words, not his, that they just cast them aside and there's no value in them.
And according to the letters, Kessler was wounded a couple of times and was sent back to the front, it seems like.
He's wounded actually in September, very early on, and I don't know if there are details in there about the wounds, but yes, he's wounded very early on, and don't have a list of all of the wounds, but typically in a situation like that, a young man could have been wounded multiple times, been taken back, and as long as the wounds are not debilitating.
They're expected to go back.
They were expected to go back, yeah. And World War I was a horrific war. It was trench warfare. The defensive weapons had not kept pace with the offensive weapons. In World War II, we saw the style of war shift as armor and tanks changed. And so the defense was that you hunker down in the trenches and then you went over the top, as they said, and without really any armaments at all, took on a defended position, which was really a horrific thing, and tremendous casualties were seen because of that.
Speaking of casualties, it was July 1st, 1960, and it still holds a place in history for the most men of an army killed in a single day. That was the British Army lost 58,000 troops that day. And according to one of the letters in your paper, this is the day that Wilhelm Kessler was killed as well. Evidently, there were casualties on both sides, not just the British that day.
Right.
And so here in the Battle of Somme, was fought over several months in 1916, on both sides of the war, over a million soldiers were killed. Evidently, this was when Kessler met his fate.
Right. The Battle of the Somme, which was a horrific battle, as I understand it. And there is a letter, actually, that we have, and it's actually retyped on letterhead from the mission office. This is from his commanding officer. I assume the painful responsibility of informing you of the death of your cousin, Lieutenant Kessler. This is writing to a relative in Germany. With many of his brave comrades, he died a hero's death on July 1, 1916, defending an onslaught by the English. On June 26th, he received a commission as an officer. Unfortunately, this happy news came after his regiment's battle and could not be awarded to him prior to his death. Please notify the relatives of Lieutenant Kessler concerning his death. The entire corps of officers regrets the loss of a gallant and dashing comrade and charming human being. I personally learned to appreciate him in the fall offensive of 1914, where he was, prior to his being wounded, assigned to my personal staff and lament the loss of a young officer whose special steadfast character personified the officer corps and was a credit to his unit. You know, I suspect that a lot of letters sound like that, that a commanding officer wants to say kind things about the soldier. But I think, at least as I read between the lines, I think that this really truly was an exceptional young man, and I think he was even taken by the people of his corps, and that it speaks to the fact that he was promoted and moved forward, that he was a faithful soldier and a good soldier.
You cite a statistic of 75 young men, I presume Wilhelm Kessler was included in that, from the nearly 7,000 Latter-day Saints living in the German-speaking missions are listed in mission histories as being killed in battle. What is the significance of that statistic to you?
Well, as I said in one of the in the early part of the article, you know, an individual death is tragedy, and thousands of deaths are merely a statistic. I think that as we look at the individuals and see the lives that were lost and the opportunities that are missed, the opportunities for a young man to be a father and to marry, and for many young women, because a lot of these young men were killed, they didn't have the opportunity to marry. And so there was this loss, this tragedy of not being able to do the things that the rest of us are enjoying doing. That's the travesty of war. And I think over time, Valentine felt, as he watched World War II unfold, that the war, unfortunately, was necessary when diplomatic means get beyond our control. And yet the horrors of the war and the destruction and the lost opportunities are truly devastating.
You mentioned earlier that President Valentine reported in a general conference talk about his mission, and talked specifically about Kessler. This was just 2 days after the United States joined or felt the need to get into World War I. Why would you say this was a bold choice for him to include this information in the talk, or based on the audience, maybe not? What
I did, actually, as I read that, I thought, yeah, that's pretty gutsy to say this 2 days after the war begins. You know, and maybe it's a reflection of the sentiment of the church at the time. I honestly don't know that, but I think that you know, as I've looked at this and we've seen Latter-day Saints fight on the German side during World War II, I think that the message that Valentine wanted to drive home was that regardless of our political leanings, and even to the point where, you know, some of us are on one side and some of us are on the other side, we remain Latter-day Saints. And we remain brothers and sisters as we are Latter-day Saints.
Which brings me to this next question. Are you aware of any contemporary examples of this similar across enemy lines correspondence?
I'm not. If you look at the Saints at War project that was done at BYU by Bob Freeman.
Second World War.
They talk about that a little bit. There certainly is that goes on during wars. In Korea, it would not have happened. I don't believe there would have been any Latter-day Saints on the Korean side. And in Vietnam, there may have been a few Vietnamese Latter-day Saints who would have joined the church and been on the South Korean side, but not that I'm aware of. Certainly not anything on the North Korean side. After the war, after the Vietnam War, there are a number of Latter-day Saints, Vietnamese Latter-day Saints, who find themselves within that communist country. And so there are those types of issues that surfaced.
So based on this relationship and these letters that we see between these two brothers, what can we gain today from this relationship?
I don't think anyone regardless of your political persuasion, would disagree with me in the argument that a war is a horrible thing, and that certainly finding a solution to the disagreements that we have between peoples is, you know, a diplomatic solution is significantly better than taking up arms and killing your brother. Unfortunately, I suppose we live in a world where, you know, we do that. We have this issue going on right now in Egypt, and it's difficult and it's sad and it's unfortunate that that for one reason or another we find ourselves in circumstances where we result in having to take a life to resolve our differences.
Are there any other specifics in this instance, in these letters, in this relationship that you would want to share today?
Well, you asked me to read some letters from Kessler, and we kind of got distracted, so if we go back and do that,
please,
for a second. This is the letter that he actually writes on the 31st of July, 1914. And this is addressed to Hiram Valentine. He says, "Before I leave to give satisfaction to my final and only destination as a German man and soldier, I want to say goodbye to you. I rather would have shaken your dear hands once more, but nevertheless, I do feel your sympathy. From the bottom of my heart, I thank you for your love and fatherly guidance. May the Lord repay you and bless you for all your direct and indirect good counsels and your correct conduct unto me. I will think of you and my mother Rose before I fall asleep. My heart will be tender when I feel your prayer, for which I will long as a child longs for food. I won't be of any service to the church under the circumstances existing at the present time, but yet of a little to my beloved country. I can truly say that in my soul I feel a firm conviction that this step I am making is not a wrong one." I think you get a sense from that that Kessler really thinks this is the right thing to do. And he says here again, this is later on in the same letter, and he actually, in this letter, he actually writes a letter, and then he continues. It's like he's taken a day or so, he's thought about it, and he's written something, and then he continues with almost what appears to be a second letter. "Please forgive me if my behavior has not always been as it ought to have been. I regret everything that might have hurt your feelings in any way. And please don't argue with yourself that I did wrong. Consider my patriotism, my rights I am fighting for, my religious view on the subject, my belief in heavenly protection, and the oath that I have spoken with a conscious German heart when called to the army." And, you know, you look at the 12th Article of Faith. It says we believe in being subject to kings, rulers, and magistrates. And so the church gives us that counsel that we should support our country, regardless of what country it is.
I might reiterate this paper is found in BYU Studies 41, number 1, from 2002. And I'm sure it's available online. Usually things like this are, if anyone would like to look into it a little deeper. It's fascinating and satisfying reading. We've been talking today with author, historian, and archivist Jeffrey L. Anderson. Jeffrey, thank you very much for being here. It's been an amazing time.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.